Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, May 22nd, 2016. This morning, A Vision for You presents The Doctor's Opinion. The Doctor's Opinion is the foundation of the whole book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and of the entire AA Fellowship. This section may simply seem to be a helpful introductory note, but without it, the entire big book doesn't make sense. The big book's approach to step one is what Dr. William Silkworth, the doctor who wrote the two letters found in the doctor's opinion, called the double whammy. Put simply, we have an allergy of the body, which means that once we start eating certain kinds of foods, we develop cravings which overpower us. And we have a mental obsession, which means that even if we stop eating those foods, our mind persuades us that we can return to eating those foods all over again. Joining us today to bring the doctor's opinion to life are four recovered compulsive overeaters. Our panelists include Janice M. from Massachusetts, Esther C. from Canada, Du L. from New York, and Amy G. from Maryland. And we'll get started with the doctor's opinion, page XXV, with our first panelist, Janice M.
Well, good morning to you, Leia M., and everyone that's on this line. And what a privilege it is to be on the same panel as the other recovered compulsive overeaters in A Vision for You. Well, you know, the commentary that Leia just said is a great summary of the absolute truth, you know, of this doctor's opinion. It is the foundation. It's the foundation of the whole book and the fellowship. You know, when I came in years ago, you know, XXV was a Roman numeral, and we just went right over this, the forwards and the doctor's opinion, and went right to the how it works. So, you know, and the more that, you know, that I studied the book, I do believe in my heart of hearts that this is the foundation. And without this, there's no sense of going on. But of course, if you're not a real compulsive overeater, this, you know, doesn't make too much sense to you. It's just like an introduction. But for me, the real compulsive overeater, this is my foundation. And of course, as mentioned, the doctor we're talking about is Dr. William D. Silkworth. And I'm just going to pull out some sentences and comment on them, except this very first paragraph has so much in it that I will comment on that. And it's we of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we have to remember that, you know, the fellowship wasn't established yet, and the book wasn't written yet. So they're talking about the people that have experienced this. They were already recovered. And that's the word that we're going to expound on, is the word recovered. That's why they believe that the reader, who's us, that you and I, if you have a problem and your problem isn't solved yet, that you will be interested in the medical aspect of this spiritual recovery, the plan of recovery called the 12 steps that's in this book. Now, they were convinced. They were convinced because they got the results. Now it says convincing testimony must. Now there's a couple of musts in this first page. And, you know, people say, oh, there's no musts in OA. Well, I see two on this page, and this is the first one. And it says convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members. That means they were suffering, but they're no longer suffering because they're recovered and have witnessed a return to health. Well, that's a loaded sentence, because convincing testimony means that, you know, there are validations, you know, there's evidence from this doctor, Dr. Silky, and proof proof. You know, to know something is to experience it. I mean, I can know of something, but to really know from my experience, and this is what Dr. Silkworth observed. He found the proof. He found these people suffering. They were suffering from their mind and from their body. And the biggest thing is he witnessed. He witnessed, he observed. There was proof that these men and women who had this allergy of the body and obsession of the mind, they were returned to health, which tells me that they must have been ill in the first place. To be returned to something, then they were very sick. And that's a big thing for me, because as myself, I just was not healthy, both in mind and body. So now this chief, he was a chief physician, a chief medical director of this hospital that, you know, specialized, which means, of course, you know, if you want to get healthy and you want to, you have a problem with your tooth or with whatever medical aspect of your body or mind, you go to a psychiatrist or you go to a dentist. But if you really want a highly skilled dentist, you would go to a specialist that does, like, you know, does gums or, you know, is good in making teeth or whatever it is. And this particular doctor, he was a specialist. That means he was highly skilled. He had a lot of proof. And this would be somebody that I would go to, you know, if I had a specific problem. I wouldn't go to, I want to go to the best. So this is what this is, convincing testimony. And I believe this doctor, you know, after many years for me, was a chosen skilled physician. And by that I mean, and this is just my opinion, he had so much wisdom way back in the 1930s that nobody else had. So to me, he was gifted, truly, truly gifted. Now, you know yourself, if a doctor recommended a course of action, cancer into remission, and kept it there for millions of people when nothing since the 1930s has been found to produce the same results, then one who had cancer would be crazy not to follow his direction. And this is what I've come to believe because of my experience with the disease of compulsive overeating. All right, so he, down to the third paragraph, you know, he met a patient. He had a patient in the hospital. And, of course, we know that patient is Bill W. And he uses the word, he was an alcoholic of a type. Well, what kind of a type was he? Well, he was the type that the doctor recognized that he was hopeless. He wanted to quit drinking, but yeah, he would, but he'd always come back. He wanted to quit, but he couldn't. Like I so many times wanted to put it down, and I did, and I was abstinent. But what happened? I couldn't keep it down. So he's talking about these alcoholics coming in and out of this hospital, and they would be all dried up. But they would go out, they'd come back again. But this particular patient of Dr. Silky's was Bill, and he was different. He was different. And how did he do it? Well, he had a spiritual experience on his third treatment, because he named him as hopeless. Now, that's pretty steep to be hopeless. And he did seem hopeless because he was so powerless. He wanted to do it, but he couldn't. So this whole thing is step one begins here. This is where step one begins. And, you know, Dr. Silkworth's contribution was indispensable, which is the foundation, as was said, of the whole fellowship in the big book when it was written. So this particular patient, Bill W., was in the hospital, and Silky brought all, you know, the problem. He brought the problem to Bill. you know, it's very simple from the big book that, you know, he learned that the real alcoholic has a body that can never get enough alcohol, or for me, it could never get enough donuts, and the mind that will not let me leave it alone. That is the basic problem with that I have. And this is what happened to these alcoholics. They could go out, but they couldn't keep that plug in the jug. And this is what happened to Bill W. while in the hospital. He was rehabilitated. He was recovered. And I think that word we're going to see so many times in this book, and we've seen it in the preface of the book, the beginning of the book, which means that he attained the aim, the goal. And what was the aim of the goal? To be recovered. He had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So it's part of his rehabilitation. He didn't just do 11/12 of the steps. He did all of the steps, because the message to give is that he had a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and it produced a personality change sufficient to bring a recovery. Now, if you're recovering, then you're in the process to be recovered, which means you're in the process of the 12 steps. Now, recovered, I always thought, oh, recovered, that means you're all better. Well, you know, you could have a cold and go to the doctor, and he's going to give you some medication, et cetera. But then the cold is going to go away, right? And you're going to be recovered from that cold. Well, with me, with my illness, I am recovered for today, which means I no longer have that obsession to set up that allergy by picking it up just for today. Just for today. So it doesn't mean cured, like some people say, oh, you're not recovered. Then that means that, no, it means that, you know, I can never eat certain foods because, you know, I have an allergy, which I'm going to have for, you know, till I die. But anyway, you know, recovered to what? Recovered to health, recovered to mind and body. And then he says, I personally know scores of cases who were is the past, of the type, here we go again, the type like who, like Bill, hopeless, with whom other methods have failed completely. Well, certainly I can identify with that. I mean, you know, we all can give our own methods of what we tried and nothing worked. So this is a fact that appears to be of extreme medical importance. Why? Because, you know, they found a... it says here, these men on the page XXVI, these men who are recovered, they don't say that, but that's what they're talking about, the authors. These men may well have a remedy. Oh, my goodness, wouldn't that be wonderful? And it did happen through the doctor's opinion, this big book. We do have a remedy for thousands of such situations. Because here we see that Dr. Silkworth endorses, you know, he's completely confident, and he recommends on that last line, which is absolutely phenomenal. You may rely, oh my goodness, rely. I was a great relying on people, on doctors, on food plans, on magazine articles, you know, but here in the doctor's opinion, I have relied absolutely, absolutely on anything these recovered people have said, reading this book, and the people that I have seen and experienced in the program of recovery, A Vision for You, of recovered people about themselves. You know, I came in insane, absolutely insane, no matter when it came to food. And, you know, I'm leaving and I'm living, hopefully, in a more sane state. And it's a trustworthy thing. What an opportunity, you know, what an opportunity. And in a nutshell, it's all about the problem to the compulsive overeater's dilemma. I can't stop once I've started, and I can't stop from starting again. And if we miss this, which, of course, I went over this, you know, for years. I didn't even know about it. So the doctor is recommending a course of action of the problem and the solution, how hopeless this condition can be, and how that you can believe in the solution because of his observation of Bill. And if it wasn't for Dr. Silkworth, you know, the little doctor who loved drunks, you know, his contribution was indispensable. And, you know, alcoholics are drawn to him, and they to him. And he was drawn to the alcoholics. And with that, I will pass. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Janice M. Continuing with our study, Esther C.
Hi, good morning, Leah. Good morning, my friends. Thank you. My name is Esther C., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. So we'll pick up the text on XXVI, starting with the words, the physician. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement that follows. So the authors are giving us an introduction to the next statement that that Dr. Silkworth is going to make. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So these authors are very good teachers because they keep repeating the same thing over and over, and we're going to see that in these two pages and, of course, in the entire big book. They make statements, they back it up with their experience, and then they make the statement again, and I guess they know how thick-headed we alcoholics and compulsive overeaters must be. But here we go. The body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So it's going to tell us, start to teach us about our problem. It did not, back in the big book, it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent for some, with some of us. So this is my experience as well. It didn't satisfy me to know more about myself. I've spent a lot of time in therapy, and I spent a lot of time analyzing my motives and my thinking, but it didn't help me because it didn't explain why I had a problem with food and why I couldn't stop eating when I wanted to stop eating, or when I was stopped, I couldn't stay stopped. So here we're being introduced to the idea that there's something more than our minds that's causing the problem. It's letting us know that something is wrong with our body, too. Now, he's not going to tell us just yet what it is, but this is by way of introduction. So back in the big book, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. So now he's telling us that we've got a physical problem as well, and that any solution to our problem is going to include or take into consideration this physical factor. Now, they haven't defined what it is yet. It's going to be in a couple of pages, but it's what we know today as abstinence. And so to rephrase this sentence, and this is critical, this is highlighted in my big book, if my solution doesn't include this physical factor, then my solution is incomplete. I will not be able to apply the solution without this physical factor. This is the first time, at least as far as I see in this chapter, where we're told in very clear terms that we've got a twofold problem and that we need to address the physical aspect of our problem. Back in the book, let's continue to read. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So there's more introduction to prepare us for Dr. Silkworth's theory on the allergy of the body, which, by the way, Bill had not known about or had not occurred to him all the years that he was drinking. And again, it's going to be explained more to us, this idea of the allergy, in a couple of pages. But like the authors, I also don't know much science, and I'm not a professional, but I am a recovered person. And when it says here, it explains many things for which we not account, for which we cannot otherwise account. I felt also that being taught about my physical allergy explained for me why I ate even though I didn't want to. And it explained to me why I ate even though I was suffering because of the food, and why I ate because I hurt others, and why I ate even though I tried to stop, and why I ate even though I was intelligent and successful in other areas and knew that I had a problem. So this idea of the allergy suddenly sets a light bulb off in my head. And it's something that we all kind of get excited to hear when we come into program. We get into the rooms, we're taught about the fact that we have a disease and that there's a physical component, and we're like, yes, that's why. That explains things that I couldn't explain till now. All right, back in the book. Though we work out our solution on a spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So it looks like before someone's approached altogether to solve his drinking problem, his mind must be clear. It can't be fogged up with alcohol or, in our case, our binge foods. So, I mean, they speak about it in a very mild terms. They say more often than not, and then you have a better chance of understanding and accepting. But the fact that it's repeated here now for the second time, you know, in one page, teaches me that it's important. So whatever I need to do to get abstinent, and I guess for some of these alcoholics, hospitalization was the answer, is there, you know, that's critical. Because, again, before I can implement a solution, I need to take care of the physical aspect of my disease. As I was reading this paragraph this morning, I thought the first sentence, you know, caused me to take a second look here, because it says here, though we work out our solution on a spiritual plane, we favor hospitalization. I thought to myself that sentence doesn't really make sense. What's the connection between the fact that our work is altruistic, that the spiritual work is altruistic, what does that have to do with the fact that an alcoholic needs to get sober before the solution can be implemented? So to me, that it was sort of an insight, and that is that we, those of us who work on an altruistic plane, we can't help you if your mind is not clear. Meaning we're here to help and do whatever we can, but we can't help you if your mind is not clear. We're sort of powerless to sort of take you further or to bring you to where we are today if your mind is still fogged up by the food, by the alcohol. All right, now we're over on page XXVII. The doctor writes, okay, finally, we're getting to the doctor's actual letter, moving out of the introductory prefatory remarks by the author. Okay, what does the doctor write? The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. So the problem, the solution to the problem is going to, you know, for these alcoholics, is going to involve some type of what they call moral psychology, which he, Dr. Silkworth, admits is way beyond, you know, the synthetic knowledge of physicians. Doctors are good, and in many ways I believe they're getting better, but here is the admission that with their training, they're not equipped to necessarily to access or apply spiritual matters to help the alcoholic, you know, the things that we're going to read about in this book. So that's a humble admission of their limitation, but yet, over on the next page, he is going to talk about the physical aspect, because in that area, he's got much experience and much to say. All right, back in the book, many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application. So these are ideas that Ebby had spoken to him about and the spiritual journey that he facilitated that Ebby facilitated for Bill. On with the text. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients, here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. So the doctors couldn't do it, but for these alcoholics or for compulsive overeaters like us, we recovered compulsive overeaters, we can bring these people back from the gates of death. And by the way, if there's three little points here which is, could be qualifications for to be a good message carrier. Are you good message carrier? Unselfishness of these men, so we have to be in a state of unselfishness, entire absence of profit motive, and community spirit. So this, these three little points here, it's a good spot check to see if one is, sort of on the mark when they're carrying the message. Okay, the last little paragraph here that I'll read. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be a maximum benefit. So there's that pesky reminder again. The author said it twice in his introduction to the doctor's words, and now the doctor is telling it to us again, and that is that I need to be freed from my physical craving for liquor. I need to address the physical aspect of my disease before psychological measures can be a maximum benefit. Now, here they're recommending hospitalization. For some of us, that might be necessary. For many alcoholics, it was. Now, my experience did not include a hospital stay, but there were are things that I had to do in the initial stages of recovery in order to get abstinent and stay abstinent. I had to limit, let's say, the type of things I baked for my family, for others. I limited vacations for a long time. I did not eat out at restaurants. I did not eat out in other people's homes. I had to limit, let's say, other purchases so that I would be able to afford to, you know, to buy things that were sort of ready to go, you know, cut up vegetables, because I found it, I wasn't used to preparing nutritious food. I was just used to opening bags and eating out of bags. So I needed to, you know, spend more money for that. I immersed myself in program, limiting all my other social activities until I was stabilized in my abstinence and more used to, you know, eating in that way. I spent hours a day doing my tools, and this is where the tools come in handy, phone calls, meetings, etc. You know, it seems pretty clear to me from these two paragraphs that we read is that I need to be abstinent to be free from the physical problem in order to move on to the spiritual solution, and that's the step work. And so coming up on the next two pages, a little bit more excitement is more on the physical allergy, and we're going to learn just what I should and shouldn't be eating. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Esther C. And we now continue our study on page XXVIII, first paragraph, with our third panelist, Du L.
Good morning.
Good morning. Du, we do not hear you. Star one to unmute. Du L, star one to unmute. It appears that Du is having some technical difficulties, perhaps temporarily. Esther C, if you'd like to continue the study until Du can return.
Okay, good morning again. So if Du gets on, she'll just pick up wherever we leave off. On the top of page XXVIII, the paragraph starts, This is a critical paragraph here. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomena of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. So this is an amazing paragraph because it's teaching me what my physical problem is. And here, Dr. Silkworth calls it an allergy. And when it comes to allergies, there's all kinds of allergies. Each allergy has a manifestation. So what does that mean? Some people I know who are allergic to nuts, the manifestation of their allergy would be, you know, blocked up airways. And someone else that I know who has a strawberry allergy to strawberries, manifestation of their disease is that they get a skin rash, and so on. My allergy, the manifestation of my allergy, is something called the phenomena of craving. Now, normally, the word craving out there is used to describe a feeling that we get when we want something. I've got a craving to eat this, and I've got a craving for that. But in the Big Book and in the 12-step program of recovery, the term phenomena of craving is used to describe what happens to me when I trigger my allergy by ingesting my binge foods. So for the alcoholics, it's alcohol. For me, it's my binge foods, I guess, which will be talked about a little bit later. But when I eat my binge foods, I experience something called phenomena of craving. And my understanding of that means, what phenomena of craving means, what does it mean when I have something called the phenomena of craving? It means that I can no longer predict or expect if I predict if I'm going to stop or when I'm going to stop. Most people can enjoy foods that they like, even sweet foods or whatever it is, you know, junk food. They could take a bite and they'll say, I think I'm going to have a half of this or a piece of that, and they have it. But when I ingest my binge foods, once I've eaten them, I'm off to the races. I have no idea. Maybe I'll be able to stop this time. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll have one. Maybe I'll have a whole pack. Maybe I'll have a whole case. I have no way of predicting. So that's what the manifestation of my allergy is, and it's very clear here that because of that, I can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Because I can't control what happens to me and what happens in my relationship to this food, once I've taken a bite, it's something that can never change about me. Once something becomes my binge food, it can never not become my binge food. This is what the doctor's opinion is taking us here. And this is contrary to what people believe, that years of abstinence somehow should allow us to pick up some of our foods that we haven't eaten for many years. That's not what it's telling us here. Once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. So once I've got this problem with my allergy, then the rest of my life becomes impossible. So it's not only that if I choose to ignore this, I'll be fighting the food for forevermore, but that every other aspect of my life is going to be affected by it. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So I was someone who was subject to a lot of frothy emotional appeal because I was fat all my entire life, like almost 4 decades till I came into the program of recovery. And you can imagine that people would say to me, you know, it was all, what about your health? And they would tell me how I was so pretty, if I could just lose some weight. That didn't do anything for me. If something, when I came into the program of recovery, it took a bit of time until I was actually brought to, the doctor's opinion was brought to my attention and was explained to me.
I'm here.
Okay. I'll just finish my sentence. But at that point, I felt like that makes sense. Everything else that people told me didn't seem to sit with me, but that did. Thanks, Leah. I'll pass.
Esther, we thank you very much. And now our third panelist, Duell. Again, we're on page XXVIII, and we'll return to the first paragraph for reinforcement. Thank you very much, Stu. Do L. Star 1 to unmute, do.
Hello? Can you
yes.
hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, hey. I'm just talking away.
I can hear you. Welcome. Welcome, and please begin.
Thank you. I don't know how much you guys heard, but I'll give an overview again of what I was sharing. Just wanted to keep my timer here for a minute. If you just give me a second while I do that. Okay. So what I was mentioning is that I'm going to mention 4 points. What is the problem? What does entire abstinence mean? And why is it that when I want to stop, I can't? And what do I need to do to overcome the vicious cycle of compulsive eating? And one of the things that the big book brings out here, it says that we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of the alcoholics on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. That phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So what does that mean? You know, as I was mentioning, there's a lot of fancy words that people like to throw around, biological, physiological, and psychological. They all mean one thing, or two things, I should say. The doctor's opinion puts it very simply. It's body, and it's also the mind. So the biological has to do with my body organs, my functions, my liver, my kidneys, the way my blood processes things. And physiological is the reactions that my body has in, you know, when I take certain substances. Psychological is the mental processes. It's my behaviors, my emotions, my habits, my thinking about how I think about the food, right? So the big book keeps it very simple. It says body and mind. So that's what I need to understand. And then my reaction to that is called an allergy. What is an allergy? High sensitivity, an abnormal high sensitivity to certain substances. So if I introduce those substances into my body, I react to that substance. And one of the key examples is, you know, when I have an allergic reaction, it says that the average temperate drinker, it never occurs to them. Never means not even one time. At any time, it does not occur. But for someone like me, it occurs all the time, right? Like if I put something in, for instance, I'll give you a true live example. You know, I had this sinus problem, right, with my nose. And for many, many years, I had this sinus problem. I come into recovery, and I decide I'm going to take care of this sinus problem finally, right? So I go to the doctor. I ask the doctor to give me something for it. And she gives me the spray bottle. I've never used a spray bottle ever in my life. But I decide to use the spray bottle. And when I use the spray bottle, I have a reaction to that spray, right? Like when I sprayed it in, all of a sudden I get dizzy. I start sweating. My heart starts beating fast. I start having a reaction to that. But you see, my mental process tells me the lies, the excuses, the justifications to get back into that, right? You would think that's insane, right? If I have an allergic reaction, that I would stop, right? So what happened to me? I think, well, you know what? I think my body just needs to get used to the spray. So I continue to use the spray to the point where I get a rash and I need to be rushed to the hospital because I stopped breathing. Now, you would think that's an insane way of doing that, right? Normal person has a reaction, they stop. They never take that again. But for me, as a compulsive eater, I'm the same way with the food. I take in the food, I have a reaction. What is my reaction? I want more and more and more of the same. Do I stop? No, I do not stop because my mind tells me I can beat the game. I can do this over and over and over again, and I'm going to find some way to beat that allergic reaction. Well, it says here, you know, that if I am that type, I can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And that leads me to the next point. What is entire abstinence? Entire means to be whole, to be complete, to refrain from something. And in my case, it's my key food ingredients, right? I need to keep away from them. I need to surrender the control over those binge foods. I need to give them up. I need to get away from them. And it says I can't use it in any form at all. What does that mean? What are some examples of that? Well, you know, entire means whole and complete means I can't be halfway pregnant. You know, either I am or I'm not. You know, I can't put in a vending machine part of the money and expect the product to come out if I don't put the entire money in. So it needs to be 100%, right? And I can't use it in any form at all. So that means I can't introduce the key food ingredients that cause me a reaction to want more and more. There are certain foods that I don't have a reaction to. Brussels sprouts. I don't have a reaction to Brussels sprouts, right? I don't go out seeking those Brussels sprouts. I don't go out thinking about those Brussels sprouts. I never even want to have Brussels sprouts. But when my binge foods is, it's like I want them and I'm seeking for them, and once I have them in my body, I go off to the races. So here is saying that I can't have it in any form at all. That means I can't bake it, I can't boil it, I can't freeze it, I can't fry it. Some examples of that is some people say, well, I can have it in the fifth ingredient, which, by the way, that's a false advertisement, right? Because the food industry spends $8 billion a year coming up with words that you can't even pronounce to include sugar, to include salt, and to include fat in there, okay? And so you don't know what you're having. You may think it's the fifth ingredient because you can read the word, but all in all, you may be having other substances in there that equal the amount of sugar. So by the time you get to the fifth ingredient, you might have it in the third, the fourth, or the tenth, and they all equal one accumulation of sugar. So that's one of the ways. There's another belief that, you know, I can have, you know, red, yellow, and green lights. There's no such thing as yellow foods, okay? The big book is very clear about that, right? It says that I can never have these in any form at all, right? But what does that equal to when I say yellow foods? It means that I'm playing around with my food, you know? It's either red, I can't have it at all, or it's green, it's good to go. But, you know, with our disease, it's like, you know, it says there's no middle of the road. Either I go through, you know, my compulsive eating to blot out the consciousness of my intolerable situation, or I accept help. I'm either doomed or I get help. You know, those are my two options. There's no door number three where I think that, you know, that I'm going to, where I'm going to have the magic pill, right? Because that's what my mind tells me all the time, that I'm going to find a way to have these foods and be content with it, that I'm going to beat the game. Well, that's not what my disease tells me, because the disease will bring me into a state of reasonableness. Now, there are other things that I need to stay away from. And if I just stay away from three or four food ingredients, right, that are killing me, and I just stay with one or two in my pocket trying to control it, it's still not being entirely abstinent. Entire means I need to give up everything, everything, everything. So, you know, and it doesn't mean also that I tend to think that it's a behavior, right? Because it says it's physical and it's mental. It's both. A behavior falls under the mental. So if I leave out the physical, my disease is not complete, because I have a body and a mental condition. And so I need to address both. So it says here that having formed a habit, and what is the habit? I continue to compulsively eat. You know, then everything becomes unmanageable. Now, why is it that I can't stop when I start? Well, It says here, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. See, it's not because I like my foods that I compulsively eat, because I ate a lot of foods that I didn't like. I ate from the garbage. I ate foods that, you know, I picked up from the floor. That's not what makes me a compulsive eater. What makes me a compulsive eater is that I like the buzz and the high that I get from certain foods. Okay? And my mind tells me it's okay. My mind tells me this time it's going to be different, right? It says the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they can't after time differentiate the truth from the false. So why do I eat? Because I keep believing the lie that this time it will be different. I keep believing the justifications and the excuses. Well, maybe if I put a little bit of alcohol in milk, then that will be okay. So if I put a little bit of sweetener into my tea or my coffee, that's going to be okay, right? So it's saying here, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. That's the lie that I believe too, that as soon as I practice these behaviors and I think this way, that it's going to be okay. And then it says they're restless and irritable unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks, which they see others take with impunity. You know, they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomena of craving develops. So, and then they come out remorseful, saying they're never going to do it again with the resolution. So what does that mean? What does that translate into? That translates that as soon as I put in any substance that I go off to the races with, I'm going to trigger the allergy. It's going to be a reaction, okay? If I never put it in, I don't have the phenomenal craving. But I have something greater than that. And it's called the mental obsession. And let me tell you something. This was very key important to understand about my disease. The disease is twofold, okay? So the mental obsession will manifest, and it will be dominant at certain times. And then the physical, if I introduce certain foods into my body, will also become dominant. So maybe one lowers and then the other one raises, but they're all interchangeable. I'm having it at the same time, and that's the insanity, that I go around this hamster wheel over and over, repeating the same thing over and over and over again, hoping against all hope that it will change. But one of the things that I've learned through this process is that unless I have an entire psychic change, there's little hope of recovery. You know, so that leads me to my last point. What do I need to do to overcome this vicious cycle of compulsive eating? Well, the big book talks about here that unless that person who seemed doomed of ever solving his problems can have an entire psychic change and follow these simple few rules. What are the simple few rules? The steps. I have to come through 3 conclusion steps, and then I have to take 4 through 9 action steps. And then I have to maintain that through 10, 11, and 12. If I don't seek out a solution, which is in a power greater than myself, I can't come up with that. So it's telling me that I can't produce this myself. I need something greater than myself to be able to produce that psychic change. You know, so that means that my mental faculty does not respond to ordinary psychological approaches. That means no therapist, no diet club, no self-will, no self-control is going to help me to overcome my compulsive eating. I need something outside of myself to be able to do that. And so the big book gives me the exact approach of how to overcome my compulsive eating. And the first thing I need to start off with is the body, which means I need entire abstinence. I need to start with my part, and then God takes care of the rest, which is the mental, which is myself, the self-will, the self, the thinking that I can control it, the thinking that I can do it myself. So one of the things that this big book and this doctor's opinion is going to help me to see is, one, what is the problem? The problem is that I have an insane way of eating my foods and an insane way of thinking around my foods. The second point is that I need to be entirely abstinent. It means completely, wholly refraining from these key food ingredients. And third is the fact that I can't stop because I have a vicious cycle that keeps me in the disease constantly. And unless I have a psychic change, a higher power that's going to restore me through these steps, step by step, I will not overcome my compulsive eating. And I hope that was helpful, and I'll pass it on to the next baton.
Thank you very much, Duell. And we will continue our study of the doctor's opinion on the bottom of page XXIX with our fourth and final panelist, Amy G.
Good morning, Leanne. My name is Amy. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from Maryland. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Great, great. Well, I could just say ditto to the other three panelists. So awesome. I'm also going to drill down on these last couple pages of the big book. Again, if we were to look at the doc op and we were to equate it with the step, it would be step one, admitted we were powerless. We admitted we were powerless over food that our lives have become unmanageable. And that's what the doc op is about. It's the description of the compulsive overeater. It's the description of me. And it's, again, reinforcing the idea of the twofold nature of the disease, the mental obsession and then the physical allergy. And for my part here, we're really drilling down on the physical aspect of this disease back to Roman numeral 24, as other panelists have mentioned. In our books, any picture of the alcoholic or compulsive overeater, which leaves out this physical factor, is incomplete. And that is absolutely the case for me as well when we're describing the allergy that Du was talking about. Again, if we go to this first paragraph, it says, I do not hold on page Roman numeral 27. I do not believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked for a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain day favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving. You'll notice craving, phenomenon of craving. And to say they mean something by these is a very important statement. So from Roman numeral 27 through 28, craving and phenomenon of craving, those words are used six times. They're talking about a phenomenon of craving. And of course, I always go to the dictionary. I love looking at the dictionary because I'm saying, look, they're trying to tell us something here. It's being said like six times. So craving, when I look it up in the dictionary, it's a powerful desire for something, or interchangeably with desires, lust, ache, need. It even describes hunger, because often when we think, even in the normies out there, when they think of craving something, they're often craving a particular food. But I understand what that means specifically. When you describe phenomenon in the dictionary is something special, completely different, or extremely unusual. So put it together, say that I had a powerful ache, hunger, need for my binge foods and my binge food ingredients, created something special to me is an understatement. Reaction. Let me give you an example, and I'll never forget most horrific binges. They were all horrific. But this, I knew about OA. I knew about what the compulsive overeating meant. You know, they say OA is like the mafia. Once you get in, you never go out, get out, because you know too much and it ruins all your binges. I'm 3 years struggling in OA. I still had another 2 years of torture to go, but I'm 3 years in. I knew a lot about OA, but I didn't want to work the steps. I was doing a kind of buffet style, you know, half measures avail, it's nothing. Well, that's what I was getting. I was focused on the abstinence. I was focused on the weight, and that's all I really wanted to deal with. So I stayed restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't know what happened. Something triggered me, and I found myself in the grocery store, walking down aisles that I said I would. And one of those, and I'm going to date myself, the bulk food aisles. They used to have barrels of bulk health food in these barrels. And I thought to myself, this is my mental obsession at work here, that carob-covered raisins was not chocolate, so therefore it was not sugar, so therefore I could have it. Raisins, hey, folks, I have in my food. I'm going to have fruit, and then I'm going to put it in a bag, and I'm going to weigh it. It's a measured, does that sound, well, of course it did to me. And so, remember, this worked with such destruction for this compulsive overeating and my binge food. What seems insane is sane. And that's what I reason to. I go into the grocery, I come out of the grocery store and I say to myself, I'm going to sit in my car, I'm going to eat these one at a time. And of course, two handfuls gone. Okay? I call it the craving for more or the chasing the next few bites. Because what happened? Might as well have been in a dark parking lot with a needle in my arm. Because that sense of ease and comfort that Dew was talking about, that's what hit me. That was my abnormal reaction because it triggered for me a craving. So, of course, I find myself without even thought back to the grocery store. But instead of the carob-covered raisins, try saying that five times fast, I also added in Entenmann pastries because my triple whammy was sugar, fat, and volume. So a couple of Entenmann pastries along with the weighed, measured bag of carob-covered raisins in the grocery store aisle at the checkout. I'm craving. I cannot stand still. I am jumping out of my skin. I want that ease and comfort. The line is pissing me off. There's too many people. Go to the next line, find the shortest line, practically running to the car, getting in the car, putting the food in my mouth before I eat no food, dropping the food on the floor, picking it up off of dirty ground, and sticking it in my mouth. That was beyond my mental control. And as a bulimic, the binge goes on because I filled my up with those foods, I went into the grocery store for and on Amy's torture and her next relapse for the next, and on I went. This was the phenomenon of craving, and it's explained perfectly in the paragraph on Roman numeral, page 28. It's here, and I call it the "It's All Right Here" paragraph. And they cannot start drinking or developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be a manifest of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This describes me to a T. My body, as Dude said, had a chemical, physical reaction. It was an allergy, an abnormal reaction, and that allergy was developing the phenomenon of craving, that desire, that ache, that need, which resulted in an extremely special and unusual reaction, which is I couldn't get enough. And let me stop here for a second. The prior paragraphs talk about this classification of an alcoholic and then the seething cauldron of debate. I don't go there with that because the bottom line is I don't care if I abused my binge food to the point of creating this allergy or whether I was born with it. I just know that I got it. As in that paragraph, we have one symptom in common is this and, of course, the mental obsession. I'm not looking for what differentiates us here. I'm looking for where I relate in. Are those two things?
Amy, I'm just going to – I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to – ask if you could adjust, or you're breaking up just a bit.
Oh, crap. Does that sound better? I moved my chair over.
How about that? Let's try it.
Okay, just let me know, because sometimes, I don't know, it's raining really, really hard here, and I have trouble at my house sometimes, so just let me know. Plus, I get so excited I'm moving around my hands and stuff. That probably does something to you. Anyway, this idea of it doesn't matter. I'm looking for what is the same, and that is the allergy and the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And those two things are what I know to be true for me. And, you know, we're not going to get into that debate. And if you're curious, if you don't know whether you're an alcoholic, I mean, the video is pretty clear, or compulsive overeater, go to page 31 and more about alcoholism. It says here, here's what you can do if you're not sure. We do not like to pronounce any individual as an alcoholic or a compulsive overeater, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room or the buffet and try some controlled eating or drinking of your favorite binge foods. Try to eat and stop abruptly. Try more than once. It will not take long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it, and may be well worth the case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. Why are they so sure that they just to make sure? Because they know, like I know, that if I have the physical allergy in my body, that when I put my binge food ingredients in my body, it's going to trigger that allergy. And when I trigger that allergy, maybe not that moment, but sooner or later, I am, well, for me, it was that moment, I'm going to trigger that physical allergy, and I am not going to be able to stop. And the key in this paragraph is it says here, entire abstinence. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Again, as was clearly stated earlier by the panelists, is that it's 100%, okay? We're people who have lost their legs. We never grow new ones. It's a done deal. Our brain needs to be cleared. Said that on Roman numeral 24. We don't work our way through the steps to become abstinent. It has to be abstinent first. Our brain cleared. But remember, we also need a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. The same person will eat again. Abstinence is absolutely 100%. Entire abstinence is the beginning, but it has to start there. It's only the beginning. It's the prerequisite, but nothing starts without it. Remember, it says here, it says relief. It says relief. It doesn't say fixed. It doesn't say cured. It doesn't say recovered. It says relief. This is where, folks, we get started. So when I think of abstinence, we're talking about abstinence, I need to define it. What is my abstinence? I'm paraphrasing from the abstinence pamphlet, or what Overeaters Anonymous says, so it's not verbatim. But for me, it's refraining from binge foods while maintaining a healthy weight and a healthy lifestyle. For me, that is incredibly important. So if I'm defining what that abstinence is and refraining from my binge foods, I need to define what are my binge foods. Those are my allergic substances that create the phenomenon of craving, that unusual special reaction to those foods that I crave, ache, need, and hunger for, that chemical reaction for me, that was sugar, wheat, flour, high fat, and volume. Now, volume can be a real tricky one, but for me as a bulimic, I had to have boundaries around my food plan to know when a food plan, when a meal started and when a meal stopped. It wasn't that my hunger or I'm full button was broken. It was. But what was really broken was the I'm going to start now and I'm going to stop now. Those buttons were completely broke because I could not start and I could not once I started. So for me, those are particular steps that I had to have a food plan for that would put boundaries around my food. Somewhere, somehow, as a compulsive eater, we have to have boundaries. For some of those are more specific. But they do not have my trigger ingredients, and they know when I know when a meal starts, and I know when a meal stops. So again, doomed. If this is me, and this is me described perfectly, I am doomed. Put the nail in the coffin, seal it, and put me in the ground because I am done. It is already said in the doc op here that we are beyond human aid. But hope cometh, okay, folks? Hope cometh. Because it says here on page Roman numeral 29, what is the solution? And what I love about these writers was so brilliant is they don't go into how it works at this point. They go into the results. They give us hope. They help me identify in. If I didn't identify in with this knowledge of what they're explaining and the description of the compulsive overeater, here we have two examples of the incredible results. Let me give you one here. This guy had lost everything, gastric hemorrhage, and okay, following the elimination, 100% elimination of alcohol, he accepted the plan outlined in this book, and he called to see me, and he said, I knew the man by name. I partly recognized his feature, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I love that word, contentment, peace, freedom from the obsession. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger. This is what I call, and what I have written in my big book, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. And that's what this guy was. He was unrecognizable to the doctor. Just to give you an example, my kids, you know, I have been blessed to have absent pregnancies. I have teenagers now. And now that they're older, I've explained more along the lines about the disease of compulsive overeating. They know I go to meetings. They know I sponsor people. And on occasion, I will say something to them like, oh, I used to binge on that. Or I'm describing something about the disease of compulsive overeating. And it's hilarious because they look at me like I have three heads, because they don't know the active compulsive overeating Amy. I am a completely different person. I'm recovered, not cured. I have that. But the deal is they don't know me because I am a completely transformed person because of the wonderful program of this Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps. So hope is here, folks. There's another example. Read it. You're on your own and know that hope is here. Hope is in this book. And then we go to, however, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book and has not had a drink for a great many years. Sold is in quotes. And I love it because when we buy something, for me, if we're sold on the instructions in this book, there's no refunds, folks, you know. We buy in. And that doesn't, you know, we buy into what I have to say. And we do it with 100%, you know, it talks about it and how it works. We stood at the turning point, you know, and there comes a decision. Are we going to work this program like our lives depend upon it? And for me, that was absolutely the case, absolutely the case. And it says here, I earnestly advise alcoholics to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. And I just want to say that, you know, I see a couple of things when I read that paragraph. And, you know, maybe Dr. Silkworth kind of scoffed when these ideas were presented to him. But like everyone has said, he had put it, there was nowhere else for him to go. He knew that there was nothing else that he could do to help these alcoholics. He tried everything. He had cleared their brains. He had defogged their brains and their bodies, and yet they kept going back out because of the mental obsession. So I almost feel like after seeing the results, he's handing it off to this program. He's handing off even all of his knowledge of being a doctor. He's handing it off to us. And he's saying, I earnestly, again, if we look up the description of earnest, you know, it's a sincere and intense conviction. He is convicted that this program works, and he intensely, earnestly asks us to read through, as the reader, to take a look at what this book has to offer. Because if we follow them, we have a chance of being recovered, where they couldn't do it. So he's saying, you know what? Hang in there. Read it through. And again, there's been a lot of talk about the physical aspect. It has to start. It's a prerequisite. But the same person, we have to learn how it is changed, about what it was like. If we go to page 52, and my sponsor did this to me, so if you want to thumb through the pages, it's pretty cool. It says here, page 52, what the bedevilments were. What was I like? The food I was putting in my body here, folks. What was I like? Well, let's see. Trouble with personal relationships, couldn't control my emotional nature, the living, had a feeling of uselessness, to say the least, full of fear, unhappy, couldn't be real help to anyone. I mean, who I was and how I reacted. But if we hold on to page 52 and then go to page 83 and hold those pages in between your fingers, lift your big book up. That is the work that needs to be done to get to the beginning of the promises. And you can read the promises on your own. The work that needs to be done, these few pages, if we're willing to follow the instructions. And again, just to wrap up, what is the sum up? They call it the description of the alcoholic. It says here, our description of the alcoholic, which means the doc op, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our lives. B, probably no empowered leave their alcoholism, and C, God could and would if he were sought. And that, of course, through the process of the 12 steps. So let's put the food down, get down to the business of working the steps. Hold up your big book, and let's work it. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you very much, Amy G. Thanks to all our panelists. And their contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so stay tuned for that. We will now transition to questions. If you have a question for our panelists, you can direct your question to any of our panelists and press star 1 to unmute and identify yourself, please.
Kathleen W. from Arizona.
Kathleen W., one moment. Anyone else?
Shoshana K. Katie from G. Maryland.
Shoshana K., Katie G. Anyone else?
Ruth M. from Oklahoma.
Ruth M. Okay, well, let's get started with Kathleen W.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, this question is for Amy G. How old were your kids when you explained this malady to them? And how old, or I mean, how did you explain it? My daughter's 10, and she's starting to ask questions, and she's kind of confused why mommy doesn't eat like the other mommies. So I just want to get your take on that. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I feel like actions speak louder than words. You know, they never saw me any different what I did when I used my food plan. And it all started with mom doesn't eat sugar. She's allergic. You know, it doesn't sit well with her. And then it moved on to, and, you know, those fats and those things, I'm much better if I keep things in a cup and kind of like a game with them. When they were younger, that's just what they saw. So they didn't know anything different. By the grace of God, they'd never seen me binging or as an active compulsive overeater. So what was normal to them was my abstinence. And as they got older and, of course, are in the learning about addictions and things like that, I would then elaborate when they asked me. I didn't volunteer the gory details, but I would volunteer that that's what mom did. And now she's grateful to have a program because they start asking questions about going to meetings and things like that. And I would basically say something, but not too much. That was always my rule, something, but not too much. And I would wait till they asked me, and I would be honest and straightforward. I would keep gory details out. And as they've gotten older as teenagers, I've elaborated more by using opportunities when they are having struggles with a friend who has an addiction. Or I had a daughter, my daughter came to me when she said that she has a friend of hers who's puking in the bathroom. So that gave me an opportunity to not only enlighten about my story, but use it as an opportunity to educate her as well. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Kathleen W. Shoshana K., your turn.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, everyone. I had a question about the physical allergy, the chemical reaction part of this. I was taught years ago from one of my sponsors that adrenaline gets released in the blood that causes a chase after whatever that substance is that we're chasing. So I just wanted to know personally what goes on in the body with and what your experience is with that from any of the panelists. Thank you.
This is Esther C. I could make a comment.
Thank you.
You know, I don't know a lot of science, and I don't think the program of recovery one should require to know exactly the effect of the foods that come into our body, because it's not just food ingredients that cause a reaction, but it's sometimes certain types of food, like certain crunchy foods for me. As I've mentioned before, a baked potato doesn't trigger me, but maybe that potato sliced really thin, baked in the oven, you know, till it becomes crunchy could have an effect. And I'm not sure that in my body it's registering the difference between a baked potato and potato chips. So I think that the best thing for me was just to refer back to the doctor's opinion on page Roman numeral 28, that paragraph which says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So however whatever the effect is in my brain, and I think today they have MRIs where, you know, showing, you know, different reactions in the brain when people eat certain things, hear certain things, or smell certain things, whatever that is, all I have to know is that I eat those binge foods or eat in compulsive ways because of the effect that's produced by them. So when determining which foods I should and shouldn't eat, I don't so much look to, like, medical, you know, backup as much as I looked through my own experience. And is this a food that could produce a reaction in me? And that, and if it is and I don't eat it, whether or not there's some physiological explanation for it. So I hope that that's helpful, and I'll pass.
Thank you,
Esther. Do go ahead.
Good morning. This is Stu. I'd like to address that. Yeah, you know, they've done a lot of studies on, you know, parts of the brain. They have this particular part of the brain. I forgot the name of it, but they've done scientific research where they say that there is a part of the brain that if you introduce certain key foods, it will cause you to compulsively eat. I mean, like, it will literally cause this reaction, right, in the body. And most people have it. I mean, like, you know, they tend to indulge in overeating at times, right? But the difference, and I want to explain the difference between someone like me and someone that is a normal eater. If you're talking scientifically, if you eliminate those binge foods, if you eliminate those foods for a normal eater, they do not have the reaction anymore. They do not obsess. They do not think about the food. They do not desire those foods. They just eliminate those foods that cause that reaction, right? For someone like me, that does not work. Because once I get started, there's no way I'm going to be able to stop unless I practice entire abstinence, right? And even when I practice entire abstinence, that's not necessarily enough for someone like me, because something happens to me also mentally. Mentally, the way I think around the food, I obsess over it. I think about it and think about it and think about it and think about it until I get back into the food. And then I tell myself lies and justify and make excuses, right? I have an unsound reasoning around the food. And that's the greater aspect for me as a compulsive eater, that I not only have something physiological, biological, right? I also have something psychological. And the psychological part is that I have a very strange way of looking at my foods, eating my foods, and behaving around my foods. So if you're like me, who is a compulsive eater, just addressing the biological, just addressing the body is not enough. You have to address both. And I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Dude. Thank you, Shoshana K., for the question. Katie G., your turn.
Hey, Leah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. This is for any of the panelists that this applies to, and just want to thank all of you for your outstanding outline of the doc op. So my question is this, right? So food, right, I get it. Flour, sugar, quantities, I'm there with you. But what I really appreciated was at some point when Overeaters Anonymous decided to expand their definition to include compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors. There's a lot of background noise, guys. That's not coming from me. Anyway, the compulsive food behaviors, and for me, like, compulsive food behaviors including things like gum and exercise addiction, bulimia, anorexia, getting on the scale 1,000 times a day. And when I do not engage in entire abstinence for those behaviors, I'm missing out on my connection with God. So I just was hoping some people could address how to discover abstinence within these expanded parameters, because it's not always talked about. They're not always common behaviors for people. And I just think, I just want to hear what you guys have to say. And with that, I pass.
Thank you, Katie. Panelists?
I could get started a little.
Thank you.
You know, Katie, my experience is really my best teacher in these matters. And let's say a person's got a plan of absence that's working, and they're doing the steps, and maybe they're already recovered. So, you know, I'm on track if I'm sensitive and tuned in to how I'm feeling, and if I'm not feeling serene and content, then often what I'll do is try to, you know, either write about it or talk about it with another recovered person. Maybe do a little audit, like if I'm finding if I'm finding that after I'm eating my food I'm not feeling quite as satisfied as I should be, then that's my signal that maybe there's something about what I'm eating or the way I'm eating that's a problem. So, for example, I used to love to read and eat, and I always thought that it wasn't a problem because since my food is weighed and measured, I'm not going to overeat, right? I would, you know, measure my food and put it, excuse me, down on the plate and then begin to eat and then read because I didn't even realize at the time, but somehow that was something very relaxing for me. But I noticed that every time I ate meals and read at the same time, I always seemed unsatisfied, and the bargaining started in my mind. Like I would say to myself, I started to have this bargaining, and was it really enough? And maybe, so that's when I realized, and it took a little bit of time and discussion with my sponsor, that behavior is a trigger for me, that behavior creates the effect in me, similar to what my binge foods did. So then I need to just give it up and then write it down on my list of, I have a list of inside of my big book cover of behaviors that I don't engage in. So I think you were asking how these evolve, and I think it just evolves from our experience, and the more time we live recovered, these things will come up. And I think just living honestly and never ignoring, you know, the signals is a good way to stay honest about our food. I just wanted to mention, I might as well do this here on the line, that I, you know, about a year ago I started to work, and now I have, the first time I ever worked, like through my lunch. Like normally in the past, my work schedule allowed me to be home while I ate, but now I'm at work. And one thing I noticed I started to do was I'd sort of be watching the screen as I was eating my lunch, you know, the computer screen. And again, I start to have this feeling after I finished my lunch that it wasn't enough, and did I pack enough, did I forget something, and whatever it was. And then I realized, hey, watching the screen is the same, you know, eat while I'm eating my lunch is the same as reading while I'm eating. So again, that, and this is a very recent thing. So just being tuned in to that discontent feeling after I've eaten, or the feeling of, you know, that I wish I could have more, or just having food on my mind is my signal that check on my spiritual work, if that's okay, am I sponsoring enough, but also to give a little audit to my food plan and my plan of absence and see if that's working too. I hope that helps. With that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Esther. Any other panelists like to respond? Okay, I'll take that as a no. Ruth M., your turn.
Hi, this is Ruth M., and my question is in general for all the panelists. I heard reference this morning to the list of foods as being red light foods and green light foods, and the comment was made that there were no yellow light foods, and I had never heard about these list red light, green light until I started listening to Vision. And I'm just wondering, I would like to hear a little bit more about them, and I wonder if all of the panelists agree that there's no yellow light foods. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Panelists, like to respond?
this is Janice.
Thank you, Janice. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning to you and everyone. Well, I you know, that came into my mind later on when I started hearing that And I do agree with red light and green light, okay? However, some of my green light foods, you know, I became diabetic. And, you know, pineapple was one of them. I'm just going to take that food. That was a green light food. You know, I could have a certain amount, according to the American Diabetic Association. But you see, American Diabetic Association handles a cross-section of the world, not necessarily compulsive overeaters. So as a compulsive overeater, that green light food became a red light food for me, because that would create, even if, you know, if I had a half, first somebody would say take a hot cup, then there was a half a cup. It wouldn't matter if it was a quarter a cup. That became a red light food for me. Why? Because it created a phenomenon of craving inside of me for more. And then not even for more for that, it would set that allergy up. That, you know, because pineapple was sweet for me. And that would set up, you know, a craving in my side, the allergy, for more of the same or something different. So I noticed when I put that down, I didn't get the craving. I didn't want more of peaches, say, peach. That didn't set up any phenomenon of craving. So that's what I can say from my experience. Sugar-free food, you know, I thought that was a green light, you know. But, of course, that became the red light because I would eat not only just two or three, I would eat the whole package if it was sugar-free. So that's my experience with that. And I pass.
This is Du.
Du, go ahead.
Good morning. Great question, right? Like, why did I make that statement that there's no yellow light? I think there's someone unmuted with a cell phone.
Yes, just a reminder, if everybody could mute, please, except for Du, and we'll have a clean line. Thank you.
So the big book is very clear. You know, if you go to page 44, it says, if you honestly want to and you find you can't quit entirely, or if when you have little control of the amounts you take, you're probably alcoholic. You're probably a compulsive overeater. So what do people tend to say with the yellow lights, right? They say the red lights are foods that they absolutely can't have. The yellow lights, they say, well, you know what, I get this sensation in my body. I get this kind of like craving, but, you know, I'm not done with that food yet. You know, I'm going to try to control eating that food for a bit while longer. Even though it's killing me, even though I'm feeling that there's something wrong with me, and the big book describes that. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They like the buzz. They like the sensation, okay? But it's so escaping that, you know, they say, well, I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure, so I'm going to put it down as a yellow light, you know? Even though I know that it's kind of like killing me, it's kind of like leading me to other foods at times, but, you know, I'm not done with that. So I'm not ready to put it as a red food, which is a food that once I go off to the races, once I put it in my body, I know I can't stop. Then there's the green foods, which they term as safe foods. You know, you don't ever have a problem with those foods. You know, you put it in, you can have the amounts that you're supposed to have. You don't get triggered. You don't want more. You don't even think about those foods, right? So those are the safe foods. Those are green foods. Yellow foods, the reason why there's no yellow foods, because if you're trying to control those foods, it's already out of control. And part of our problem, part of being powerless over our foods, is that we are always trying to control. And if I'm trying to control it, it's already out of control. How do I know that? Because my life becomes unmanageable. My eating becomes unmanageable as a result of me trying to control. Now, the big book also says on this page, you need to be honest. Nobody else is going to tell you what those foods do to your body. Only you yourself know what those foods do to your body. So either you can go on, you know, being in denial, okay, you know, making excuses, or you can face the facts and face the music and say, you know what, these foods are killing me. I need to put them down, you know, because nobody else is going to convince you. A person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. No one's going to convince you. The food is going to convince you. The food is going to bring you into a state of reasonableness. You know, when you feel the pain of that, then maybe you'll do something about it. But until then, you know, people say that because they want to be playing around with the food. That's what it equates. It equates that I want to continue to play with my food. You know, so you have that option. But it says here clearly in the big book, you have two alternatives. You either go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation, or you accept spiritual help and put down the binge foods. I hope that was helpful.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ruth M., for your question. Anyone else with a question?
Good morning. Yes, good morning. I have a question.
And your name?
Yes, hi, my name is Hina R., H-E-E-N-A, Hina R.
Okay, one moment, Hina. Who else has a question?
Deborah R.
I didn't get that.
Deborah R.
Okay, Deborah R. Hi, Deborah, one moment. And who else is would like to?
Gladys F.
Gladys S. Anyone else?
F.
Okay, go ahead, Hina.
Thank you. Can you hear me clearly? Can you hear me clearly enough?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I've been wondering about something for some time, and the last question and the answers really touch on it. And that has to do with the idea of having pleasure while eating. And how the experience of pleasure, just enjoying food, seems to me can sometimes activate the craving for more, just enjoying it. And I'm really, I guess I need to work more with my sponsor on this, but I'm wondering if somebody could speak to the question of pleasure. Like, is pleasure... to what degree is pleasure a problem for people with compulsive overeating? I think that's the question, more or less. Thank you, and I'll mute.
Thank you, Hina. Panelists?
It's Esther. I'll try to take a stab at that.
Thank you.
Hina, my experience has been, and I've only been around for about 9 years and recovered for 6 of them, is that it's best for me when my food is, I think the word is perfunctory, like it's obviously food I like to eat because I don't eat foods that I don't like, right? It's nutritious and abstinent, and it just is. I know that when I first came into program, I saw a lot of people taking their abstinent ingredients and making concoctions that would resemble things that they used to have in the past. First of all, for some people, that in itself, those itself are binge foods. So if I'm able to somehow make a cake using only absent ingredients, but it's producing the same effect like the original, maybe not as much of the effect as the original binge food, but still yet an effect, so it's still a problem for me. Food for me is what I do to maintain my body because in order to serve my higher power best, I need to be in a healthy body. And as I know better, I'm going to do better. And sometimes my food plan does evolve. Now, this idea of pleasure associated with eating, I do get that from newcomers. And they say, what's wrong with enjoying your food? And I think for a normal person, enjoying food shouldn't be a problem. Just the same way I can go out and do a little shopping and maybe buy something that wasn't on my budget, a small thing, because I'm not in Debtors Anonymous. But when it comes to the food that I do, I am a compulsive overeater, albeit recovered, but I am a compulsive overeater. So I can no longer use food in that way. And the reason is because when I used food to bring me that, you know, those certain sensations or, you know, for pleasure, as you mentioned, it's a behavior that blocks me from my higher power. And I am so in need of his power to keep me recovered and so dependent on that primary relationship for everything good that's in my life, I cannot afford to start now leaning on food to bring me that sensation. I mean, my feeling of peace and serenity and enjoyment in this world cannot come from whatever I put into my mouth. It needs to come from my relationship with my higher power. Now, here and there, I can enjoy other little pleasures of life because those other pleasures, as I mentioned, making a purchase or taking a walk or watching a sunset, those or having a relationship, those things do, in a sense, bring me pleasure, not to replace that relationship with my higher power, but in order to enhance my service of my higher power. But food will not do that for me. Meaning, if I somehow start to do things with my food with abstinence spices, I'm not going to – that those games that I play with my food and that way of making, you know, sort of increasing the pleasure for my food is not going to enhance my relationship with my higher power. It's going to take me away from my higher power. So that's why when it comes to food, you know, my best meals are the simplest meals. I don't usually eat out. There are a couple places where I can eat. Everyone knows very clearly what I can and can't eat. But they always feel bad for, you know, that they weren't able to somehow embellish it and make it better. They always feel like they wish they could do more, you know, to make my food more interesting. And I always say the greatest gift you could do is just follow my instructions, and because I don't want the food to be interesting. I already did 40 years of that, and I already know the results of that kind of living. So I hope that that's helpful for you and puts this idea of pleasurable eating in perspective, and that's my experience with that. I'll pass.
Thank you very much, Hina, for your question. Thank you, Esther. Deborah R., your turn.
Morning, everyone. This is Deborah, and welcome to my Vision for You family, and enjoy this day. There was one lady, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name at the moment. You mentioned that the pages, I think 52, where they start the bedevilment to 83. I just wanted to thank everyone, if I jump around here, for your shares this morning. They've meant a lot. But the one that mentioned page 52, I think, to 83, if she could confirm that page so that I can be correct when I pass this on to my sponsee. Thank you.
That was Amy G. She had to step off the line, but yes, the bedevilments can be found on page 52. And, of course, the promises are on the bottom of page 83. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gladys, your turn.
Good morning. This is Gladys. My question is, I was kind of in and out because I was getting ready for work.
However, I heard one of the panelists mention about the beginning of abstinence start with, you know, with me. And I just kind of like wanted like a recap of exactly what am I supposed to do. Because I have a history of like some long-term recovery, but recently it's just been like the most 47 days abstinence, and I end up picking back up.
Okay, Gladys, I just want to make sure we have your question. Your question is, could you rephrase your question, please?
Okay, one of the panelists mentioned that the first part of getting abstinence begins with me. That part is up to me. So what am I supposed to do? How do I, the beginning?
Okay, thank you for the question. Panelists, who would like to address Gladys, please?
This is Do.
Do, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. What do I do? You know, do I have some choices, right? I guess that's a question that you're asking. Page 23 is going to answer that, okay? It says on page 23, the first paragraph, it says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. So, you know, if I never, ever, ever introduce my binge foods, it's saying that I am not going to trigger the phenomenon of craving. It is so simple that they call it academic. Simple. Academic. Elementary. Okay? I don't introduce my binge foods, I don't cause the phenomenon of craving. But now there's a problem, right? Because that's my part. That's the part that I take care of, right? I look at my key food ingredients. I look at my binge foods. I see the foods that I go off to the races, right? Once I take that first bite, I know that I can't stop once I start, right? And then once I'm stopped, I can't stay stopped because there's another aspect to this, right? And it says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So I have a faulty thinking, right? And my faulty thinking, it says, if you ask him why he started on the last bender, the chances are he will offer you what any 100 alibis, right, or defenses. Sometimes these excuses, justifications, rationalizations, have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc of the alcoholic creates, drinking about creates, right? So it even says, if you draw this fallacious reason, this faulty thinking, right, that we have, it will always bring you back to the food because it will always tell you the lies, the justifications, the excuses that this time will be different. And that's why we need to work through the steps. Once we get abstinent, right, is identifying those key food ingredients, not all foods, but those foods that cause you the allergy of the body, the one that, you know, once you start, you can't stop. You need to put those down. That's the first step. You're talking about what do you need to do? What's your part in it? Your part is to put down the food. Then God takes care of the rest. And you co-create with God, right? How do you co-create with God? You work through the steps. You do 2 through 12, right? It's getting connected to the higher power, working like your life depends on it, right? You clear away the wreckage of the past. You clear away those things that block you from accessing that higher power. And then you look at how to get restored, right? So it's going to take you step by step. So the first thing that you need to do is get together with a recover sponsor who has gone through this process of identifying those key food ingredients that cause you the allergy of the body. You know, so it says here, it's elementary, it's academic, it's simple, right? But the problem is that not everybody wants to give up their binge foods, okay? Not everybody wants to let go of that. And also, the fact is that we have a mind that keeps telling us, I'm going to think about it, think about it, think about it, think about it until I get back to the food. You know, so we need to work the steps. We need to get through the steps in order to be relieved of that thinking. And with that, I pass.
Thank you, Du. Thank you, Gladys, for that important question. Any other questions? Do I hear Janice?
Yes, please. I just want to briefly address that. I love Gladys's questions all the time.
Sure.
Okay, you know, people have come to me and they said, but you say I'm powerless. If I'm powerless, how can I put the food down? Well, you have to have that willingness. You know, I have to speak of myself. Before I came to OA, I already knew the foods that created me to have more and never be satisfied. I mean, I think most of us know, but we don't want to admit it, like it was just said. I know donuts. I tried so many times my experience. I would have just go out and say, oh, please just get six. And then I would say I'd freeze the rest. You know, I knew that the donuts created the allergy to be activated. We know that, but we don't want to be honest with it before we came in. We're not powerless about putting the foods down, like whatever they are. They're not. I'm not powerless over putting asparagus down because I don't have a problem with asparagus. I knew that before I came in. But give me a donut. Oh, you know, maybe this will work. So I'm really not powerless about putting it down. I'm powerless over the allergy that food or substance creates in me. That's what I'm powerless over it. So if you put it down and you say, gee, I don't have any craving, then you know that's a trigger food. I mean, we know that already, you know, like I said. So that's a good question. With that, I pass. Thanks.
Thank you, Janice. Any other questions that have not been addressed yet?
This is Laura G. I have a question.
Okay, Laura G. Go ahead.
Awesome. Good morning, everybody. Laura G., a compulsive overeater. Just big blessings to... my question is... I don't remember hearing anything about, I heard so much. Let me focus. The coming back, you know, a lot of times I always think about the newcomer because I feel like every time I'm on this line until I'm recovered, and I can say that confidently, that I will just keep coming back because, you know, we all learn and process and get closer to higher power in our own way. And sometimes it takes some of us longer than others. So I was wondering if you would touch on the keep coming back. And I think sometimes it helps with the newcomer and understanding that just like the addiction that some of us have had our whole lives, which some of us are old, it's going to take just as long to replace it with another habit, which is recovered by not going to the substance anymore. And so the question is if you could explain the keep coming back, maybe even touch on, like one of you said, you've been in 9 years and you've been recovered six or something along those lines. So that keep coming back thing holds true to that experience. And I hope that was clear. Thanks.
Thank you, Laura G.
Hi, it's Esther. I'd like to respond to that. Please, go ahead. I'm not sure you'll like my response, Laura, but I'm not sure which... My experience was that I was in program for 9 years, but... Back 10 years earlier, I had come to Overeaters Anonymous, and thank God I didn't stay because I'd still be sitting in that same meeting, although I think it's closed since, with a bunch of some overweight, some not overweight people who'd say things like, I've been in OA for 13 years and I'm abstinent for 7 weeks. But keep coming back. I mean, it's not that we're kicking people away and we want OA to be a place where people could come and recover and end their suffering. But sometimes the best thing for a compulsive overeater is to go out there and eat and binge like crazy and suffer because when they come back, they're good and ready. And that was my experience. I tried OA in the late 80s, and I didn't keep coming back. And once again, about 5 years later, and I didn't. Also, I went to a couple meetings, and I didn't come back. But by the time I came in, 10 years after that, I was good and ready. And although it was a few years till I got recovered, it was mostly because I hadn't met anybody who talked about the big book and who could take me through the steps. But my journey in those 9 years was always upward, meaning I came in and I got abstinent. And you know, according to, for example, what my sponsor was guiding me, I was abstinent. At some point I had a break in abstinence because I wasn't recovered, and then I met people who were, and someone took me through the steps. But I never, at no point at that time was I unwilling to do what I was told. And again, I think it's because I had suffered a lot. So when I meet people, newcomers, who come in and they're argumentative or they're not sure, I never try to convince anyone to stay. I don't tell them, you know, come to meetings and maybe it'll all, you know, settle in by osmosis.
I say to them, you know, go out there and let John Barleycorn do its job. Go out there and let all those binge foods convince you once and for all, because sometimes it takes a good hard knock to get us to be willing to do what we have to do. So again, don't misunderstand my words to say that we don't appreciate newcomers. Newcomers is our lifeblood, right? Because in carrying the message, how we stay recovered. But if they're not ready, I don't know if it's a great favor we do to them, stringing them along in bad meetings, or, you know, just using OA as a place to unload and as a support group. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Esther C. Any other panelists want to respond? Okay, I'll take that as all.
Is this due?
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I also like to answer that question. The Big Book's very clear. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffice. So for me to say, keep coming back, that's great. You know, I love for people to keep coming back. But that's not enough. That's not enough to say, keep coming back, if they're not willing to do the work. Right? If they're not willing to give up their binge shoes, if they're not willing, it's a person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. I'm not going to convince anyone to give up any binge foods. I'm not going to convince anybody to change, right? Only the disease, the pain, that the food is going to be the greatest motivator to effectuate change. It's only when they're ready and they're willing. For some, it says the Big Book, that is a tedious process. We hope that you don't have to go through that, right? To be beaten and beaten and beaten, 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 and then maybe one day you'll get it, right? If you want to come to the rooms of OA and take up space and take up time and, you know, not do the work, you're welcome to do that, right? Or you can accept spiritual help, go through the work, try recovery, try to see what that looks like. And if after you get recovered, you don't like what you have, you're welcome back to your misery, you know. So the Big Book is very clear. You know, if people don't want this, you can't drag them to get it. And people that want it, you can't keep them from getting this, right? So people that don't want it, you know, it's like a master teacher. Can't teach them. And people that want it, even Mickey Mouse can teach them. Okay? So that's the difference. You know, it's like, yes, we want people to come and get this. We're not saying don't come back. You know, the doors are closed to you. But are you really willing and ready to do the work? You know, that's the real question. It says here that the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have death and weight. And I think a prior speaker touched on it, right? That, you know, this is not about a drunkalogue. This is not about a dumping ground, right? This is about the solution. And the problem with OA a lot of the times is that people come in and they use OA as a diet club. They use OA for therapy. They use OA for, you know, other than what is here, which is the message of recovery. You know, so it says, you know, unless you're willing to get this, unless you're willing to put down the food, unless you're willing to do the work, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. So you could keep coming back all you want. And you know, I believe that you're not ready until you're ready. You're not ready until you're ready. And the disease is going to get you ready. You know, for some, it takes years. For some, it takes months. For some, it takes weeks. Some it takes days. It all depends on how far you are in that progression of the disease. For me, it took me a long time to get here. But once I got here and I was beaten and I was pummeled and I was bloodied, I was ready. You didn't have to tell me, where's the water? I'm going after it. You know, you don't have to drag me there. I'm chasing after it, you know. So you don't have to worry about it because God's under control. He has all situations under control. He knows what people are going through, and he will meet each and every one where they're at. And so we don't have to get into the result business. We just have to do our part and get connected. And that's what this program offers. I hope that was helpful.
Thank you, Du. Thank you, Laura G. And on that note, we're going to close this morning. Again, thank you to all four panelists. And, of course, thank you to those who had questions this morning. Appreciate your participation in that way. We'll close from page 164, A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.